Hello, I'm Deepak Bhatt from Boston, and it's my pleasure to moderate this session on ischemic heart disease, mitigating the risk of sudden cardiac death. With me today to discuss this topic are Roxana Maran from Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York and Bill Weintraub from Christiana Care Health System in Newark, Delaware. Each year, over 1 million patients have a myocardial infarction, with many more patients hospitalized for unstable angina. It's estimated that there are close to 400,000 deaths a year in the United States that occur as a result of ischemic heart disease, and there are over 500,000 stent procedures performed on patients, many of whom have acute coronary syndromes, such as an acute myocardial infarction, but who remain at risk for recurrent events, even if they have no or limited symptoms after revascularization. Just how to manage these patients entails educated decisions based upon an assessment of risk, and that is part of our task today. We plan to discuss a few different ways of risk stratifying patients, something that remains a challenge, in particular in terms of trying to predict mortality. As they say, prediction is difficult, especially of the future, and that is especially true for mortality. An accurate risk stratification after primary PCI for STEMI is quite important in guiding future patient management. There are a number of different risk scores and models that are out there, but we're going to focus on two particular ones, the Cadillac risk score and the more recent National Cardiovascular Data Registry modeling. And I really can't think of two better people than our discussants today to get into both of those different models and considerations on how to best risk stratify patients and then treat those at high risk. Perhaps, Roxana, we can start with you and the Cadillac trial. If you could just remind everybody in brief what the trial was and the different variables that were collected there and then how the risk score was calculated.
Thank you, Deepak, for allowing me to discuss this important topic. As you stated, prediction of mortality after an acute myocardial infarction is an important one, and if we could risk stratify patients, perhaps we can make an important impact on their outcome. And in Cadillac, as you know, 2,082 patients or so, about 2,100 patients with acute myocardial infarction, were randomized to stent versus balloon angioplasty. This is an older study, and the stents were all bare stents, with or without apsixamab. This was a great study, actually, to use as a basis for a developmental database, perhaps, for a risk stratification algorithm for patients with acute myocardial infarction. And what we did in this, what we call a Cadillac risk score, developed the variables using this particular database from the Cadillac trial, and then validated it using the stent PAMI trial, which is an older study with 900 patients undergoing primary PCI, comparing stenting versus balloon angioplasty. So the variables were chosen based first on a univariate predictors, and then in the final model for both 1 year and 30-day mortality, ejection fraction less than 40%, presence of renal insufficiency at the time of STEMI, the Killip class presentation of 2 or 3, final TIMI flow, which was suboptimal, 0 to 2, and age greater than 65, presence of anemia, or presence of three-vessel disease, the burden of coronary disease at the time of presentation. All of these were important in predicting the risk mortality, predicting mortality, and the addition of putting these in and giving integer scores to all of these, and the one that was most important was left ventricular ejection fraction less than 40% was score of 4. And this really had a great predictability both in the 30-day and 1 year mortality with C statistics of about 0.8, 0.82. So a very a good predictive model that can be used at the time of STEMI presentation. It's very simple. You don't need important baseline angiographic predictors, but certainly you can use some of these parameters to predict mortality.
Oh, that's really great. How about GFR? Was that in the score?
Yes, presence of renal insufficiency. It wasn't at that time. Renal insufficiency was any creatinine greater than 1.5, so it wasn't a estimated GFR. Now, as you know, we're really asking to look at estimated GFR, and that about creatinine of 1.5 really equated to patients with estimated GFR of 45 and below.
And how about other things like the location of the MI, say an anterior wall MI versus an inferior wall MI?
So that was in the univariate predictors, but it didn't pan out, in fact, because left ventricular ejection fraction was a more predictive, so less than 40%, that was much more predictive than the location of the MI. So in the multivariate model, that's the one that really gained the most integer score of 4.
So maybe the ejection fractions incorporating what prior scores had sort of split out as the heart rate and the blood pressure, for example, which had in other models been shown to be powerful predictors. Maybe the EF sort of incorporated that patient whose LV had taken a big hit.
Yeah, and I think it really points out to the importance of performing some modality to assess LV function during that first hospitalization of a patient with a STEMI. I think that's a very important predictor of how these patients do down the line. We know that recurrent rehospitalizations are also very much related. The first 30-day readmissions are very much related to that baseline ejection fraction or the discharge ejection fraction.
Yeah, that's a great point.
So it's an important one to assess at the time of STEMI.
How about diabetes?
Diabetes did not pan out, believe it or not, in this model. I think in the multivariate predictors, it was there in the univariate predictors, but didn't pan out in the. And we didn't have that many diabetic patients. We're about 22% or so in the Cadillac study.
Yeah, so that's interesting how diabetes wasn't in there. Bill, what about the CATH PCI registry? That's given us a lot of insight into any number of different issues, but specific to predicting risk and predicting survival. What can you tell us from that important registry?
Well, Deepak, thank you for asking me to represent the National Cardiovascular Data Registry in discussing these our prediction models. Now, the ACC CAP-PCI registry is largely an in-hospital registry, so we had to be able to get long-term follow-up data. We did that by linking the registry to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services database, that is the Medicare database, to get long-term survival, and we were able to do that after 3 years. And our patients are from the years 2004 through 2007, and we have over 340,000 patients in the model. We divided it into a derivative model, derivation model, and a validation cohort. And that allows us to do the modeling in the most appropriate way. And then we divided the patients into those without STEMI and those with STEMI, allowing us to have two different models. And then we looked at risk factors for less than a month, 1 month to 12 months and greater than 12 months. And we have 24 different variables in the models. And what we found was that the severity or acuteness at the time of presentation were the strongest predictors, especially in the first month. So if we look in our model with STEMI, patients in cardiogenic shock had a hazard ratio of over 4, and similarly in the patients without STEMI. So how sick the patients were initially were the most important thing. However, I agree with Roxana that it's very important also to look at left ventricular function, and we did find that ejection fraction was a strong predictor. And that remained a strong predictor throughout, but again, was most powerful in the first month.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And, you know, in terms of predicting mortality, then it sounds like this is a good model. Are you able to specifically predict whether that mortality is from heart failure or from arrhythmia?
No, we can't in this model, although we know, especially early on, that the patients have a high probability of dying from an arrhythmic death.
Great. Well, you know, with these two sorts of ways of risk stratifying patients, I think it actually is quite useful to determine that a patient is particularly high risk post-PCI, or I suppose for that matter, particularly low risk. But from a physician perspective, we tend to focus on those that are at high risk. What do you think we can do to further improve their risk beyond just, you know, the ACE inhibitor, ARB, beta blocker, dual antiplatelet therapy, blood pressure, lipid control? What other things can we do in terms of drugs or devices that you think is novel or worth considering more than we do? Roxana, maybe I can just start with you.
Well, I think, you know, there are clearly some guidelines on treatment of these patients, especially when the ejection fraction has been disturbed, or it's very low, or less than 40%, for example, or 35%, and clearly these patients can benefit from obviously, as you said, ARB and beta blockers and all of those. But beyond that, the big question is whether or not the use of implantable defibrillators are going to be important in these patients, and we all know that post-STEMI, specifically with STEMI, there is that change in the ejection fraction that needs to and there's that whole remodeling process that needs to happen. And the big question that comes back to me and to all and in the guidelines, there has to be a waiting period before you actually assess the left ventricular ejection fraction before you determine whether an implantable defibrillator should be placed in the patient for prevention of sudden cardiac death. But I always wonder, how many patients do we lose in that interim, and how much better can we actually assess those patients? And I don't know that the data is out there for those patients in whom we're just not sure. You know, where that waiting period of I believe it's like 90 days or so that we need to wait before we would make that assessment to actually place an implantable defibrillator. I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah, no, that's really a great point, and that's a tough situation, especially for a high-risk patient who's had a big MI. EF appears to have taken a big hit. Of course, even out to 3 months, as you know, post-PCI, there can be recovery of LV function. Nice work that's documented that, and in part that's why guidelines and even coverage decisions have been based on waiting a period of time before putting in an implantable defibrillator. However, a proportion of those patients, of course, will continue to have low ejection fraction and will be at risk during that waiting period, and that's a vulnerable period potentially. Bill, what do you think? What can we do for those sorts of patients that are high risk? Certainly, they ought to be on good pharmacotherapy. One pharmacotherapy I didn't mention that I'll throw out will be aldosterone antagonism, which I think tends to be underutilized in patients that are post-MI and with heart failure. But in terms of defibrillators and optimizing their timing and use, do you have any thoughts?
Well, I do. First, let me say I agree with the thoughts about the importance of pharmacotherapy. And it's not just enough to know that that patients should be getting these. We have to follow through and make sure patients actually do get the pharmacotherapy they need, because we know that many patients actually don't. And we don't really live up to the guidelines by applying them in practice. So there is a gap there. Now, in terms of risk, I think it's clear that in patients with depressed ejection fraction with post-myocardial infarction, that they will benefit from defibrillators. The clinical trial data is clear on that. And it's also clear that patients can't have return of left ventricular function. And that's why the national coverage determination for ICDs recommends this waiting period. And that's a period of great danger. that first month or so. And the models that we have from the NCDR clearly point to this, because the patients have a greater risk from in these high-risk subsets in the first month, so that cardiogenic shock in the STEMI model in the first month has a hazard ratio of 4, but that drops after a year all the way down to 1.2 and is no longer even statistically significant. So our patients are really at great risk in the first month, even though many of them will have return of left ventricular function. So there's a gap, a treatment gap, in which I think there's an opportunity to save lives.
Yes, so you raise a good point. I'd mentioned the risk in those patients who have a low EF, whose EF remains low, but there are also those patients, even though there's recovery of EF that might be substantial, for a period of time the EF is in fact diminished and they're at risk then. So for both those patients, there can be that vulnerable window. Do you think wearable defibrillators are a potential option there?
Well, that's one of the few options we really have to try and prevent sudden cardiac death in those patients. It would be great to have more data, and there's an ongoing trial to look at that right now. But it's a very difficult trial, very difficult to enroll patients. So right now, that's our treatment option, and we do want to see more data.
What do you guys think about some of this home monitoring that can be done? I think one of the issues about these patients is that, not that they get lost to follow-up, but you actually brought it up, Bill, regarding adherence to the medication and guideline therapies. And I think that there is still some room for improvement on that front. And some of these home monitoring devices that are out there that are smartphones, for example, they could have some potential impact on perhaps even reducing some of the readmission rates, but also surveying those patients who are at high risk, and knowing that there are ways to even do some electrocardiographic, 2 or 3 lead home monitoring devices that are out there. What do you guys think about those in the future?
Well, I think there's a lot of promise to that idea of getting patients more involved with their health care and using technology to augment that. Though I think one of the problems with sudden cardiac death is it's hard to predict it until it happens, other than by relatively crude measures like low EF and so forth. So, I think that sort of technology for someone who might have transient AFib it could be potentially useful, say, to determine if there's a recurrence of AFib after an AFib ablation. But in terms of further risk stratifying for sudden cardiac death, I'm not sure there really are that many additional electrocardiographic markers that, that type of app-based approach would really help with. But, Bill, I'd be interested in your thoughts.
Well, I think Roxana raises a very good point. I don't think we've explored that as fully as we should. And there are companies, particularly in that space, using radio-transmittable waveforms that would allow us to really investigate that in much greater detail. So it would be great to see some research if people could raise funding in that particular area. I think there's tremendous potential to find people at greater risk. And I think that we should look into it further.
Yeah, anything that further enhances our ability to risk stratify and target therapies to high-risk patients, I'm sure would be cost-effective. Don't you think, Bill? You do a ton of research on cost-effectiveness.
Oh, I think absolutely. Right now, the way we approach cost-effectiveness in clinical trials most of the time is look at everybody. So everybody gets everything, and that's something that we really can't afford to do anymore. So, I think that people have thought about personalized medicine and trying to risk stratify and making sure people get what they need is somehow at odds with evidence-based medicine and clinical trials. But that's not the case. In fact, we've got to make these things work together.
Yeah.
Bill, something that's bothered me a lot, and I'd love to hear both of your views if time allows us, is that when a patient that comes in whom the ejection fraction is quite low, even in the 20%, why do we have to wait that 90 days? I mean, can the remodeling actually bring this patient to a place where they could be protected beyond the 90 days? I mean, those are the cases that really bother me a lot. And those are the patients that, based on the guidelines, we can't just go in and throw in a defibrillator.
Yeah, it's not just a matter of guidelines. It's also national coverage determinations. This
That's
is
right.
coming from CMS. And if you put it in without a national coverage determination, and bill for it, there can be difficulty. And the Justice Department is actually weighing this right now, so it's really fairly uncertain where this is going to lie. But I think for the cases with really low ejection fraction, you raise a very good point. I think where CMS is going to back off are people who have known low ejection fraction and then come in with a recurrent MI. And to wait in those patients, I think, is clear. That's irresponsible, and we shouldn't be doing that. So I think we'll see some changes in the coverage determinations.
Yeah, that's a very subtle and important point you raised, Bill. Those are really different patients because their EF after their MI is certainly not going to get better than what
right.
it was before if it was already low.
But, and we see a lot of patients like that. This is not an unusual scenario.
Absolutely.
We'll have patients with an EF of 30%, 25%, and they'll have a relatively mild and STEMI. It hardly changes anything, but they've really been at risk all along.
Yeah, but certainly the data, though, Roxana, don't support putting in an implantable defibrillator very early on after a de novo MI, at least in terms of that being superior to waiting. And there are just those patients that do recover substantial amounts of myocardial function post-primary PCI, even out to a couple of months after the procedure, one of the great benefits of primary PCI.
Right.
Well, it's been a terrific discussion, really insightful comments from both of you, and I think a topic that clinicians have to weigh every day, how to best risk stratify patients coming in with a STEMI, getting primary PCI, and trying to decide what best to do to further decrease their risk. I'd like to thank the audience members for participating in this program. Hopefully it was interesting and educational. You may now take the CME post-test by clicking on the Earn CME credit link. Please also take a moment to complete the program evaluation that follows. Thank you very much for joining us.